You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new law in Alabama aims to get tough on people with fake service dogs. Our guest says the law was needed to help people with real service animals. Right now, it's time for a weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. First, the sentencing of a former priest in northern Wisconsin who confessed to sexual abuse has been delayed. The multiple incidents of abuse took place as early as the 1980s when Thomas Erickson was serving as a priest at St. Peter's Church in Sawyer County. He was arrested and formally charged late last year. Laura Schulte is the public issues and watchdog reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. Laura, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Laura, you wrote about this. When did police over time become aware of the allegations of abuse?
So police were aware of the abuse as early as 1983. There is actually a time when parents of one of the victims reported Thomas Erickson to the Sawyer County Sheriff's Department. They brought him in. He actually confessed to some of his crimes, but the sheriff's department elected to turn him over to the diocese at the time to allow them to dole out punishment. So he didn't face any legal charges at that point.
And how did the diocese react, and what did they do when it came to Erickson and these allegations?
Erickson was laicized, which means he was, you know, stripped of his title as a priest. And he eventually moved to Minneapolis, where we believe he had family living. He, you know, was sent to do some type of counseling within the diocese of the Minneapolis-St. Paul diocese, which it's unclear if that ever helped him or if that would be able to help him, because he continued harassing children after that.
Right. So can you give us a little sense of the subsequent allegations that came up over the years?
Yes. So about 9 years ago, some of the survivors went to the Sawyer County Sheriff's Department. This had been a huge part of their lives. They've been grappling to deal with it, and they went to investigators. And investigators began looking into it, and then in 2011, another gentleman came forward. And investigators, you know, looked into this. They actually got another confession from Erickson in 2016 and forwarded their investigation to the Sawyer County DA's office. The DA elected not to press charges at that time, and that investigation sat on his desk for probably about 4 years before we started submitting some records requests, because one of the victims came to us out of frustration. 2 weeks after we submitted a records request to the DA, Mr. Erickson was arrested last November in Minneapolis and brought back to Wisconsin.
And Erickson was scheduled, I understand, to be sentenced this afternoon, and that's now been delayed. Why?
It was delayed. There were two investigations in Merrill and Lincoln County that were not included in his pre-sentence investigation. That's a document that basically helps the judge make his decision in sentencing. And, you know, under some of the rules in Wisconsin, the victims, you know, need to have their story heard and considered, even though that those two investigations didn't result in charges with the plea deal. So they've allowed them, the court system has allowed a month for investigators to include those two victims in their statements in the pre-sentence investigation before sentencing can happen.
And so when is sentencing now expected to happen?
It should happen at 1 p.m. on September 26th.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Laura Schulte, watchdog reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. She gave us an update on the case of former priest Tom Erickson, whose sentencing for sexual abuse has been delayed after more victims came forward. Now, a state-run ad campaign trying to convince millennials to move to Wisconsin is more than a year old, and officials say they plan to keep it going despite a big change in state funding. Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
This ad campaign to get millennials to move here to Wisconsin was rolled out early, I think it was last year. Can you remind us what these ads were pitching?
So the ads were pitching sort of the quality of life factors in Wisconsin compared to some areas, other areas in the Midwest. So they talked about things like commute time or housing affordability, kind of trying to pitch Wisconsin as a place where you could go and have a little bit more work-life balance, which is definitely something we hear in conversations about millennials.
There's a new administration now, a new budget. What's the before and after as it affects this millennial ad campaign?
So the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which oversees this ad campaign, actually put in a request to increase funding. in the next budget, the current budget. They wanted about $10 million to keep the program going. They had $6.8 million previously. And Governor Tony Evers did not meet that request. He didn't include it in his budget proposal, and then Republican lawmakers didn't, throughout the budget process, insert that money. So basically what's happening now is, since the money wasn't included in the budget, WEDC has found resources within its existing budget. They kind of found some things through savings and other programs that they were able to reallocate. So the program is going to continue, even though it wasn't funded in the state budget.
What's been the argument, especially from Democrats, against this idea that we should be advertising to lure millennials to the state?
So they're essentially arguing that they don't want to spend money on a marketing campaign. They want to kind of focus resources on making Wisconsin more appealing, kind of in and of itself. So make the state better, foster programs that we think millennials are going to get behind, and kind of the state markets itself. So they said they want to spend more money on things like public transit, more bike paths, a student loan refinancing option that's backed by the state, some other things that they think millennials prioritize and would value.
And who are we targeting? There's a group of cities, right, that are the key target markets here.
That's right. So WEDC did a fair amount of research before they rolled out this campaign, and they decided they were going to focus on 13 different cities throughout the Midwest. This is a Midwest-focused campaign. So we've got cities in Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota, Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, and Missouri. It's kind of some likely characters you might expect, like St. Louis and Minneapolis, but also some smaller communities that folks might not be as familiar with, like Champaign, Illinois, Dubuque, Iowa, places like that.
I know it might be hard to measure, but do we have any indication of whether this campaign has been working?
So WEDC did do a survey after about a year of the campaign. They went to these communities and they asked questions of millennials, like, how likely would you be to move to Wisconsin? What are your perceptions of Wisconsin right now? Then they went back a year later and asked the same questions over again. And based on those findings, they said that people are 9% more likely to move to Wisconsin than they were when these ads first rolled out.
We'll see how they work in the future. Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She joined us to talk about the marketing campaign pitching Wisconsin to out-of-state millennials that will continue despite a change in state funding. Finally, the Ferry Bluff Natural Area near Sauk City is one of the best places in the state to see bald eagles. Now a land donation means it's expanding by more than 30 acres. Susan Endres is a reporter for the Baraboo News Republic. Susan, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, for those of us who haven't been to the Ferry Bluff Natural Area near Sauk City, can you give us an idea of what it's like?
Sure. Yeah, it's about a 10-minute drive west of Sauk City, and it's on the Lower Wisconsin State Riverway. So the most scenic views there come from hiking up the trail, which isn't very long, but it's a fairly steep incline, so it might be a little difficult for some people. And once you get to the top of the trail, you have these really great views of the Wisconsin River and Honey Creek from more than 300 feet above them on a sandstone bluff. And there's other natural things to see there, dolomite harbors and prairie remnants and forested areas. So it's a really beautiful area.
Now, people like this, but it sounds like eagles love this place. Can you talk about why this has been a good area for bald eagles?
Yeah, the Lower Wisconsin River is one of only three winter concentrations of bald eagles in the entire state, according to ecologist Jeff Barzin, who's a member of the Ferry Bluff Eagle Council. Ferry Bluff, in particular, provides undeveloped shoreline where the birds can perch and feed during winter, and has plenty of area inland where they can find shelter from winter winds. And Barzin said it's the only nighttime roost for eagles that's fully protected, because all of the others are on privately owned land where they can be disturbed and the land could be developed in the future.
And now the new story there, it's being expanded, it sounds like, by about 30 acres. How did this land end up getting added?
Well, the owner of the land approached the DNR looking to sell it. And while the state didn't have the funding to acquire it itself, the DNR sometimes partners with conservation groups that can fundraise and organize efforts to get the land, which they then donate to the state. And that's what happened in this case. Groundswell Conservancy purchased the land for about $160,000 and presented it to the state in June.
And it sounds like there was a big fundraising program from donors, kind of big and well-known, to small donors, too.
Yeah, that's right. Groundswell worked with the Ferry Bluff Eagle Council in doing this, and representatives from both said there was a lot of local support. They also obtained a grant from the state, which covered about half the cost, but the rest was paid using private donations from individuals, businesses, and foundations. And one of the bigger donors was Craig Culver of the Culver's Restaurants, which were started in Sauk City. So there was that, and Alliant Energy also contributed some money, and there were just a lot of small donations as well.
And are we going to end up with trails in this part of what will be this part of the park?
Yeah, eventually they do plan to make it more of an accessible natural area. Right now, you can go there, but it's not so easy to hike because there aren't any trails. But I heard that the DNR plans to develop it a little bit for that in the future.
Susan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Susan Endres is a reporter for the Baraboo News Republic. She joined us to talk about the Ferry Bluff Natural Area, a popular spot for bald eagles, and it's going to be expanded by 30 acres. She wrapped up our weekly review of stories from around the state. When you see somebody with a dog wearing one of those service animal vests, how do you know it's legit and not just somebody's pet? Because you can just buy one of those vests online, put it on a dog, and take them wherever you want. Our next guest says it's a problem that's harming not only the people who actually need service dogs, but in some cases, the general public. This weekend, a new law is scheduled to take effect in Alabama that will penalize people who falsely identify their dogs as service animals. Our guest says that doesn't go far enough. Frances McGowan is the executive director of Service Dogs Alabama. Frances, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, there's a lot of confusion, I think, for people who don't deal directly with service animals. What makes a dog, say, a service animal versus what people call emotional support animals or things like that?
Well, often people get emotional support animals and service animals, service dogs. Dogs are the only animals that can be service animals. Service dogs, animals, emotional support animals, and therapy animals. And they get these confused quite often. A therapy animal is one that is trained in just basic commands, and it's taken to hospitals and nursing homes to do reading programs in schools by its owner. So it's an owner handler, and the dog works usually a couple of hours at a time. And then an emotional support animal is an animal that is assigned to somebody with a doctor's order, but it falls under the Fair Housing Act. It is not under the American Disabilities Act. And so it has to do with the animal being able to reside with the person who has the disability. And then a service dog is one that is trained to go into public, has public access everywhere, except for places that it would be a health risk, like in operating rooms, sometimes emergency rooms. And so it does have public access, and it is trained to do tasks that assist the person with a disability to live a more normal life and be independent.
How common is it for people to, in effect, fake having a service dog, to say their dog is a service dog when it is not?
Well, you're looking at two different issues here, because the person may not have a disability and they just want their pet dog to be with them. So the person is faking a disability. And then you have people that actually have a disability, but they have an untrained dog. They have a pet that they're attached to, so they just buy an internet vest and put it on it. So you've got fake people, and then you have fake dogs that are not trained to be service dogs.
Now, for people who have that legitimate need for a service dog and have a trained service dog, what kind of problems does this cause for them when you have people, as you say, just buying some kind of service animal vest online and slapping it on an untrained dog?
Well, let me say something about the vest online first, because the vest companies, the people that sell the vests and the IDs online, are never hold anybody accountable for anything. You fill out some paperwork, they send you an ID card, and they send you a certificate, and they'll send you a vest. And so nobody ever sees the dog or interacts with the dog or the person. So they have no clue. But the names of these organizations are things like U.S. Registry for Service Animals, or United States Certification for Animals, American Certification for Service Animals. So they sound like they are government entities, and they are not. So it's a problem because people sometimes just don't know. They don't know. They think they are registering their animal to be a service animal with the United States government and under the ADA law, which they are not. So the problems that this is causing, and people, the regulations are changing because now entities that are using different types, like, for instance, airlines have now had to put in more stringent guidelines for people bringing animals onto their planes, because I don't know if you've flown lately, but sometimes it feels like you're in a barnyard on those airplanes. So they have gotten stricter. Those are mainly emotional support animals. And in actuality, there's a lot of misinterpretation of the Fair Housing Act as it pertains to emotional support animals, including that they really are the law was originally designed, I believe, the law was originally designed to allow people who did have anxiety problems and some disabilities that did not really need a dog for independence, but was very reliant on the dog in the home to keep a dog with them where they lived. And the ADA is not like that. The dogs that are service animals are literally life-saving and life-changing dogs. These people have a very hard time even being in a public area without the support of a service animal and the task that it performs for them.
Talking to Frances McGowan, Executive Director and co-founder of Service Dogs Alabama. A new law in Alabama targets people who say their dogs are service dogs to get them into, say, restaurants and other public places, but they really aren't. So what changes, Frances, under this new state law there in Alabama?
Well, what it does, and other states have implemented other restrictions and guidelines, but mostly they are voluntary registration programs in different states. Our law was created to warn people about having animals that were fraudulent. However, we still are under federal law. We are still under the ADA law. And the ADA law says that you are able to ask people two questions. One is this a service animal? And the second one is, what tasks is he trained to do for you? And those are the only two questions that you can ask. And obviously, a person that's taking a fake service dog out or a dog that is untrained, then they're going to tell you it's a service dog. And you cannot ask anything further than that. Now, there are reasons that a dog can be asked to leave a place of business or a public place, and they are things like the dog is completely disruptive to the other customers, or the person is unable to manage the dog by himself or get the dog under his command, or the dog becomes aggressive toward people or other dogs, or he's not housebroken, or he's completely destructive in an area, which would also be the disruption of business. So you have reasons that you can ask a dog to leave, but you don't have the authority to get them to demonstrate anything. And anytime you're asking for an ID card, you don't know if you're getting a real one from an organization that has trained a dog or a place where this dog has gone through training, and or if somebody has just purchased one online. You just don't know, and you can't ask.
And Frances, in our last minute, is there a better change, a better system you'd like to see put in place?
Well, I would like one of the really good things about all of the states implementing different laws is that it does get the federal government to recognize that we're all dealing with a real problem with fake and untrained service dogs. It is a huge problem. It can be a safety issue and has been a safety issue in our state. And it's very destructive, and it harms the people who really do need these animals to assist them.
But is there a federal change that you think might help solve that, just briefly?
Yes. There needs to be some kind of a federal regulatory system for accountability for service dogs and for the people who have them. There needs to be guidelines. There needs to be guidelines at all. There are hardly any guidelines whatsoever. And there's no way for us to ask people any questions that would let us know if that truly was a service dog or not. Even if you ask a person, what task is this dog trained to do for you, and they can't answer the question, there is still not much or nothing that you can do.
We'll leave it there. Frances, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for calling me.
That's Frances McGowan, Executive Director and co-founder of Service Dogs Alabama. We talked through about the problems caused by people falsely identifying their dogs as service animals. Her state, Alabama, just has a law that's coming into effect to try to deal with that issue. We pay a lot for health care in the United States. The issue is a big part of presidential campaign politics. But our next guest says we're overlooking one of the biggest causes of health care problems that drive those costs, even though it's right there on our dinner plates. Dr. Dariush Mozafarian is a cardiologist and the dean of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. He co-wrote a recent piece on nutrition and healthcare costs in the New York Times opinion section. Dr. Mozafarian, welcome back to Central Time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Well, connect the dots for us. The food we eat, you write, is in many ways driving our need for healthcare and the cost of healthcare. Why?
I mean, it's really shocking and, you know, kind of unbelievable how much we spend on healthcare. The country as a whole spends $3.5 trillion. That's more than $10,000 per man, woman, and child per year on healthcare, and it's almost 20% of our entire economy. It's almost 30% of the whole federal budget is spent on healthcare, and it's only going up. And from, you know, the Affordable Care Act to, you know, multiple efforts over the last 20 years, you know, people have tried everything with physicians and drugs pricing and, you know, HMOs and all of these things to reduce healthcare costs, when the reason healthcare is costing so much primarily is we're really, really sick. More than half of Americans have some form of cardiovascular disease. Almost half of all American adults have diabetes or prediabetes. More than, you know, two-thirds of Americans are overweight or obese. So more of us are sick than healthy, and the number one reason for all of that is our food and changes to our food system in the last 30 or 40 years. And when you put together the impact on obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, stroke, certain cancers, let alone all of the other things we're learning about, allergies and, you know, mental health and, you know, the gut microbiome, you know, food and nutrition is by far and away the single biggest driver of poor health in this country. And so, you know, I'm alarmed that when we're having the Democratic debates now, when we had the election, you know, debates 4 years ago, when we're going to have the 2020 primary presidential debates, you know, those debates ask about every possible question about education, about the Middle East, about, you know, security, about the environment. And yet the single biggest question for our economy, which is how do we get healthcare costs by having a healthier food system, is not asked.
What parts of our food system, what kinds of food do you see driving these problems, the diabetes, the prediabetes, the obesity?
Well, I would say, you know, that there's a set of things that we know, and I can answer that question, you know, reasonably well, broadly. And there's a whole bunch of things that we don't know, and I can't answer that question well. And so we both need to attack and address the things that we understand and then really significantly invest in research to understand the things that we don't. I can't answer that question perfectly, but what I can say is we very broadly know, big picture, that, you know, there are probably five or six really important things in our food that are harming us, and five or six protective things that we're not getting enough of, and they're both important. And so on the protective side, you know, Americans aren't getting enough fruits and nuts and beans and vegetables and, you know, healthy plant oils and fish and yogurt and minimally processed whole grains. You know, the across the board, Americans are eating too few of those protective foods. And focusing on those protective foods, getting them to be, you know, cheaper, more accessible, available everywhere, more convenient, you know, there's lots of very specific policies that can help that. And then on the negative side, it's actually not a long list, but it's a lot of the food supply. So lots and lots of refined starch and sugar. And I bring up refined starch like white bread and crackers and, you know, breakfast cereals, because people think about sugar, but they're sort of forgetting about starch. That's about 40% of calories in the whole food supply is just refined starch and sugar. And then very, very high sodium foods, processed meats, soda. A pretty short list, but that short list is more than half of the foods, you know, in our food supply.
Talking to Dariush Mozafarian, cardiologist, dean of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. He says we have a health problem in the United States. We have a healthcare cost problem in the United States, and they're both being driven in large part by the food we eat. Dr. Mozafarian, I think a lot of people, when we think about diet and nutrition, that's an individual issue. That's the choices we as individuals make. In your piece and in some of your other work, you want to say this is also a policy issue.
Yeah, I mean, there's no major, you know, public health issue or safety issue in this country that we've ever addressed through individual choice alone. Imagine if you told the average parent that 80% of toys in the toy store we know are unsafe and they will harm your child, and some of them will kill your child. But it's totally up to you. It's individual choice. You have to read the label, you know, go to the toy store and shop around the outside of the aisles. Don't shop in the middle aisles in the toy store, because that's where the most dangerous toys are. And if you're, you know, a little bit less educated or have lower income or are busy, you know, sorry, you're going to get more marketing for those unhealthy toys. And it's just individual choice. Or imagine our cars. Our cars 80 years ago were really unsafe. And over the last 80 years, there's been remarkable improvements in car safety, huge changes to the car, to the roads, around drunk driving. And that's been driven by innovation, by policy, by culture change, by systematic changes, not just by targeting the driver. We have the same drivers today that we had 80 years ago. Your house has all kinds of safety rules. You don't want to buy a house and then find out that, you know, it doesn't meet earthquake standards, it doesn't meet fire standards, you know, the electricity's unsafe. We have standards for chairs. We have standards for desks in our offices. We have, you know, a lot of things that we appropriately do to make sure there's kind of a minimum standard of safety. And for our food system, we have developed really good standards of safety for, you know, infection control, for bacteria in food, right? You don't want to go into a restaurant and have E. coli and say, well, it's individual choice, eat the E. coli, right? We regulate that and make sure that policy is effective. But somehow, when it comes to food and chronic diseases, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, you know, this has so far been seen as an individual choice issue. But if you look at the obesity epidemic, if you look at, you know, kids that are 2 or 3 years old that are sick, if you look at all segments of society that are being affected by this, businesses that are being crushed by rising healthcare premiums, small business owners who can't, you know, afford healthcare for their employees, you know, this is a systems issue, and we can fix it, and it's win-win. Right, it's not like tobacco, where we're trying to put the food industry out of business. We want to help the food industry make healthier food that's you know, affordable and accessible, and, you know, help them and incentivize them to do so. So this is really win-win, and there's no loser. We have a healthier society, we have lower healthcare costs, we're more productive, and in fact, if we can become the 21st century breadbasket for healthy food for the world, right, that's a huge economic boon to the United States, because this is a global challenge.
Talking to Dr. Dariush Mozafarian, dean of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. He's with us to talk about how our diet impacts our health. In many cases, it's bad, he says, and the healthcare system is feeling the hurt from that, too. We pay for it in healthcare costs down the road. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see federal policies out there to encourage the production and consumption of better, healthier food? Do you want to see efforts to stop the consumption and production of less healthy food? where you live. Is it hard to find fresh, healthy food that you can afford and get it into your diet? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about changes we can make to improve nutrition in the United States and how that would affect healthcare costs in the country. Dr. Dariush Mozafarian is with us from the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. He's a cardiologist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to hear politicians, maybe presidential candidates, talking about food policy as part of the healthcare debate here in the United States? Do you find it hard to eat healthy? Healthfully, day to day. Do you have questions about our food system? Would you approve of the idea of maybe taxes on unhealthy foods like soda? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Mozafarian, let's get into some policy changes you'd like to see now. First of all, on the you were talking about protective foods, the good stuff we need to be eating. What kind of policy changes would you like to see to help make those more available?
Well, I think, you know, the one of the most important messages I have here is that we're not talking about a nanny state, you know, determining what people eat or don't eat. We're talking about rebalancing the system to actually account for the true market and societal costs of unhealthy eating and the true market and societal benefits of healthy eating. So kind of restoring the market to some sanity. And so, for example, in healthcare, the electronic health record, which it tracks everything about a person's health, generally doesn't include anything at all about nutrition. So just think of that irony. The number one cause of poor health in this country isn't tracked and asked about in the electronic health record. There's policies that could get nutrition into the electronic health record. There are prescription programs that many companies, many healthcare systems are actually trying, where they give a prescription to the patient, they pay for part or all of fruits and vegetables or other healthy produce. And what they're finding is not only, you know, does it make the person healthier, it actually saves the healthcare system money net. Even after they account for their subsidy for healthier food, it improves the health of the patient. Government could, you know, give incentives to businesses to develop and market and innovate and create foods that are healthier. Whereas right now, what happens often is they're penalized. They spend money and they make a healthier product and they have trouble getting it to market because of all the competition. So I think there's a range of things that could be done. And it's not just government. Private work sites, which, again, most Americans are covered through their worksite health insurance, and they're paying for this, you know, through the nose. So private work sites should really be aggressive about, you know, the cafeterias and other wellness initiatives. We work with John Hancock Life Insurance, Tufts does, to help support the science behind a really innovative program they have where they actually reward their life insurance clients for healthier eating. So here's a life insurance company that's paying their life insurance clients for healthier eating, helping them, supporting them to buy healthier food, because it makes business sense, because they live longer and they share in some of those costs. So there are a range of policies we've outlined in our New York Times piece that really could be initiated and tested, you know, right now. And over 5 or 10 years, we could put a huge dent in this problem.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in West Allis. Nick, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make, I guess, a comment and question, because I think that a lot of people really think that diet is the key to solving a lot of problems. And so frequently when the medical system doesn't know what's wrong with you, they tell you to change your diet when the diet may or may not be causing your problem at all. And so I think we just have to be kind of careful about telling everyone that they should just change their diet and whatever is wrong with them will get better, because that's not always the case. And if we assume that the diet is the problem, then we frequently will push people to constantly change their diet.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Mozafarian, I assume diet isn't always going to be a quick fix for an acute problem they're having currently, but you're saying down the road, yeah, it really is going to make a difference.
Well, you know, we and others have spent a lot of time doing careful research to understand, you know, what is the actual impact. And absolutely, you know, the caller is right. Not every death and not every disease in the United States is due to diet. But that being said, you know, we've calculated and others have calculated that, you know, more than 500,000 deaths every year in the United States are directly due to poor diet. And just from cardiovascular disease and stroke and diabetes, which are influenced by diet, almost 1,000 deaths every day, about 40% of all the deaths from those causes are due to diet. So certainly it's not the only cause, and you know, we need you know, to do a lot of things to improve health in this country, but it's a major, major cause and overall the number one cause.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Chris in Milwaukee now. Chris, hello.
Hi. I heard you mention that maybe we should tax the bad foods, but it's like taxing cigarettes while we're giving tax breaks to tobacco farmers. Right now we're giving tax breaks to farmers who farm all kinds of bad things. If we took the tax breaks away from sugar and corn and animals and gave the same tax breaks to the farmers of vegetables and fruits and nuts, then the poorest children would end up being the healthiest people because their mothers could never afford anything unhealthy. But the apples would be, what, a penny, a nickel?
Chris, thanks a lot. So tax and subsidy policy, for that matter, Dr. Mozafarian.
Yeah, so I think tax and subsidy policy is really important, and we should subsidize probably at the retail level, probably at the purchasing level, healthier foods. And again, that could be done through Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare and Medicaid could pay for part of a prescription for a healthier food. SNAP, which is, you know, the largest feeding program in the country, food stamps could also, they have a program right now which incentivizes fruit and vegetable purchases through subsidies that could be expanded. I will say that this concept that the farm subsidies, that there's direct farm subsidies to sugar and corn, that's really not that accurate anymore. 20, 30 years ago, that was true. Now, almost all of the farm bill that has those types of programs in it, it's crop insurance. It's not, you know, a direct subsidy. And none of those programs actually make the crops cheaper. Farmers never want their crops to be cheaper. So farmers like the farm bill, and there's no program in the farm bill that makes crops cheaper. So the farm bill and agricultural subsidies is much more complicated than people think. And in fact, we actually, corn syrup, high fructose corn syrup in the United States is more expensive than natural Brazilian sugar. So we put tariffs on sugar to raise the price of sugar in the United States to protect our corn farmers. Otherwise, you know, Brazilian natural cane sugar is cheaper. So agricultural subsidies are complicated. And there's this notion that's been around in the press that we're subsidizing unhealthy foods through farm subsidy. That's actually not true. But we should subsidize healthy food through, you know, Medicare and Medicaid and SNAP, among others.
We'll leave it there. Thanks for that call. And Dr. Mozafarian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. And, you know, this is something that we can all fix together.
That's Dr. Dariush Mozafarian, Dean of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. He's with us today to talk about what we can do to have a healthier diet and the effect that changing our diet could have on our healthcare system and our long-term healthcare costs in the United States. Wisconsin farmers have faced a lot of challenges this season, from things like unfavorable weather to the ongoing trade war, which has helped keep commodity prices low. Hope Kerwin visited a field day in western Wisconsin to hear how farmers are adapting to these more challenging conditions.
Damon Smith is a plant pathologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. In a cornfield near Black River Falls, he points to a section on the edge of the field where the corn stalks get shorter and paler in color. Smith says that's where floodwater settled earlier this spring.
As the water receded, some of this corn was able to emerge, and then some of the corn in the middle here never did emerge. It just pretty much rotted in the ground. Yeah.
Much of Wisconsin was inundated with rain this spring, on top of a wet fall in winter. That meant many farmers had to wait longer than usual to plant, and fields ended up uneven, like this one in Jackson County. And Smith says delayed planting set farmers up for even more challenges later in the season.
We tend to look at specific growth stages to make some of our, you know, fungicide application decisions, for instance. And when you have a field that ranges two or three growth stages, you know, it's So when do you pull the trigger, you know?
Making good decisions about when to apply chemicals or other management practices isn't just about best protecting crops from diseases. It also helps farmers save money. Jamie Paff is the agriculture educator for UW Extension in Jackson County.
When you're spraying multiple fields, that could, and you have to put on more than one application, that could make or break the bank, really, for some people. So they want to do the best they can with their crops, but because the bottom line is so important, they're really trying to get the timing right.
With lower yields expected, PAF says saving on inputs has been top of mind for producers, especially those carrying a lot of debt after years of low commodity prices. It's what Ray Butke from Maryland, Wisconsin, is most worried about. These days, he rents out most of his 500 acres to neighboring farms, and he's concerned about neighbors who borrowed during times of high prices in order to grow their operations.
They're having a hard time getting their crops in, and they've been, some had to sell some assets in order to keep going. And I tell you what, it's just, if it turns around a little bit, they'll be all right. But some of them, it's not going to be able to.
Butke says farmers do have one thing on their side, new tools and access to information to help them keep input costs down. Damon Smith from UW-Madison says more farmers are reaching out to him on social media. He's got an active Twitter account where farmers tweet photos from their fields or ask questions about certain diseases. And he's developed smartphone apps to help producers decide when and how to apply chemicals. Tools like these will become more important as Wisconsin likely sees more frequent wet weather thanks to climate change. This year's rainy spring was an anomaly, but Smith points out the state has seen prolonged wet weather at the end of summer for several years now.
We've been in these patterns where we've been generally below normal in terms of temperature, but above normal, of course, on rainfall. And when we have years like that, it's very conducive for many of our fungal diseases. And so we've really, you know, struggled in corn and soybeans, especially over the last several seasons.
Last year, a fungal disease called tar spot swept through cornfields in southern Wisconsin. It's already been confirmed in 9 counties so far this season. Ben Nestingen from Blair, Wisconsin, says he uses Smith's smartphone apps when he can get service. Nestingen helps his family grow corn and alfalfa for their livestock, but this is the first year he's planted his own acres of corn. He says the challenging weather hasn't changed his mind about his career.
If you want to keep going with farming, you're just going to have to deal with the ups and downs, and some years it's going to be good, some years it's not so good.
Nestingen says he's hopeful better corn prices are in the near future, and farmers will get back to the good years once again. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, young people have a love-hate relationship with social media, and that's creating a lot of anxiety. That's according to the author of the new book, The Happiness Effect. We'll find out why, and you can join the conversation. A state lawmaker joins the show for a look at investigations into complaints at a veterans care facility here in Wisconsin. And the state is home to a world-renowned archive of labor history. We'll take a Labor Day tour of the Wisconsin Historical Society's labor collection and what's available to the public, researchers, and students. Plus, a look at music education in the country. Our guest says we need to change the way we think about it. That and more, all coming up Monday here on Central Time.